Living 1948, in recognition of the opening of United Nations Week, is privileged to present the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Warren Austin, the Assistant Secretary of State, George Allen, and the National Chairman of United Nations Week in the USA, Mr. Clarence Francis. Living 1948, brought to you each week at this time by NBC and its affiliated stations, departs from its customary practice of presenting a drama document a day and instead plays host to three Americans who, like all of us in 1948, are also world citizens. Here is your narrator, Ben Grauer.
If public opinion is to be truly helpful to the policymakers of the world, it must be enlightened opinion. Here in the United States, there is an organization whose purpose it is to keep us thus informed, the American Association for the United Nations. Largely through the efforts of this association, this present week has been officially designated United Nations Week. And now here is the national chairman of United Nations Week in the USA, Mr. Clarence Francis.
In this third annual observance of United Nations Week, the theme is clear-cut and direct. In order that we as American citizens may work to make the United Nations the foundation of our foreign policy, we must know its aims and objectives, its accomplishments. And what is most important, we must know what the United Nations is capable of accomplishing if it is to become our watchtower for tomorrow. "We can work it out together or fight it out alone," is the slogan. Throughout the nation this week, communities are working together in United Nations Week observances, and opening ceremonies such as this one are taking place in hundreds of towns today. Throughout this week, public discussions and forums are being held, looking toward a better understanding of the problems facing the world today and the way in which the United Nations is working to help solve these problems. Each day of this week is to be devoted to a different phase of United Nations activities. One day to economic accomplishments, another to political accomplishments, and so on. In small study groups and large community forums, the people of the United States will be studying and learning about the United Nations and its vast machinery for world cooperation and world peace of mind. The important point is that this studying not stop on October 24th. It must continue throughout the year, this year, and the years to come, if we are to have a successful United Nations. Public opinion is more important than ever to the process of collective security. It is vastly important that the world organization which we have today becomes bigger and better and stronger as time goes on. Anything which is not fed dies. The United Nations must be fed with faith and support of the people it serves. Let's know the facts and make ourselves able to cope with the world situation today, cope with it intelligently. We can do this if we know what we are talking about. We can work it out together or fight it out alone. We all have a common duty. The world is engulfed in a titanic struggle for peace. Our first duty today and every day must be towards helping to achieve that peace. This can be done through the United Nations.
Thank you, Mr. Francis. Public opinion is a valuable guide to leadership, but it can never be a substitute for leadership. Ultimately, the decisions must rest with the experts, the men in possession of all the facts, and with the experience proper to evaluate the facts. In the field of American relations with the United Nations, the experts concerned are those of the U.S. State Department. Today, to bring us a clearer picture of how our experts view the United Nations and what hopes they invest in it, we have with us one of the nation's chief foreign policy makers, the Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs, Mr. George Allen. Mr. Allen, United Nations Week, which we observe beginning today, comes at a time when the United Nations is being put to the most severe test of its existence. Many of its loyal supporters are apprehensive. What do you see as the basic issue before the UN?
The basic issue before the UN, Mr. Grauer, is clear and concise. It's whether democracy, as we know and use the term, shall survive or whether the totalitarian concept of the police state, with its concentration camps and slave labor for political dissenters, shall continue to extend its sway.
Well, then you don't feel, Mr. Allen, that the question is one specifically of the control of Berlin, but rather a larger issue?
Mr. Grau, the shepherd boy on the plateau of Iran cares little about the control of Berlin. But he will be vitally concerned by the debates and decisions taken in Paris over the Berlin question, since the principle at issue is whether force and coercion, such as the Soviet Union is using in blockading Berlin today, and is often threatened to use in the shepherd boy's home in Iran, shall continue as an accepted method of conducting international relations.
Well, Mr. Allen, I sense from what you say that you feel America should take an important part in these discussions. Now, why, many people would ask, should the United States be called on to take the lead in supporting the United Nations when other nations geographically, like perhaps Western Europe and the Middle East, are more immediately concerned?
I agree that all those other nations should be working every hour of the day and night in the most fervent support of the United Nations and to help strengthen it. But we must be realistic. The only nation in a position to take the lead in building a strong United Nations is the United States. We alone have sufficient power and detachment, if you wish, to enable us to do it effectively. Without our strong support, no nation or group of nations could make the United Nations effective. If this was true a generation ago when the League of Nations was founded, it's doubly true today.
Now, Mr. Allen, just one more question, if I may. We stand tiptoe on the third anniversary of the formation of the United Nations through the UN Charter at San Francisco. What do you see as the immediate future of the United Nations?
85 years ago, Mr. Grauer, when the United States was undergoing its severest trial, the president of our union spoke of the conflict at that time as a test to determine whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, could long endure. We pray to God that the United Nations will be spared the ordeal of a resort to arms to test its fate. We hope that the common sense of mankind will arise even in areas where the voice of the individual is today stilled by a dictatorial regime. We face today a basic issue. No one knows its outcome. But whatever the future may hold, I look forward with supreme confidence to the ultimate triumph of the principles of democracy embedded in that stirring phrase which opens the charter, "We the people of the United Nations."
Thank you, Mr. Allen. In the halls of the United Nations, America has distinguished representation. We are served at many levels by State Department officers, sociologists, economists, military advisors, agricultural experts, and medical men and women. But essentially, our delegation proper is a diplomatic corps, and accordingly, it is headed up by a senior diplomat. He is Warren Austin, United States Ambassador to the United Nations. Earlier in Paris, at the scene of the United Nations, Ambassador Warren Austin was interviewed by John McVane, NBC's observer and commentator at the United Nations. Here now, recorded, is that interview.
This is John McVane at the United Nations in Paris. The National Broadcasting Company today presents from the Chaillot Palace Ambassador Warren Austin, chief of the United States mission to the United Nations. Ambassador Austin?
On this occasion of the opening of United Nations Week, sponsored by National Broadcasting Company, the National Education Association, and the American Association for the United Nations, in cooperation with the many great national organizations which have given support to the United Nations since the days of the San Francisco Conference, I want to say, first of all, thank you. The concerned interest and continued support of the American people have been vitally essential to those of us who have tried to express the American point of view in the United Nations. Before you put your questions, John, let me try to characterize the significance of the General Assembly session and the Security Council meetings in Paris. we are meeting as representatives of 58 member nations in the center of a Europe which is now headed toward economic reconstruction and self-reliance. The fact that it is being organized by Europeans with a definite promise of aid by the United States gives a lift to the people of Europe. Despite all attempts to sabotage the Marshall Plan, the European Recovery Program is working. To its purpose, the constructive forces of labor, agriculture, and industry are rallying. The production lines on the European charts are going up. That means a rising internal strength for the European members of the United Nations and a declining opportunity for totalitarian obstructors. This new sense of confidence is reflected in the forthright speeches we have heard in Paris these last 2 weeks, especially from Mr. Bevin of the United Kingdom and from Mr. Spock of Belgium. But they do not speak as representatives of separate countries. They are able to speak as collaborators in a growing system of European association and unity. I sense a new dimension in this General Assembly. It is in the apparent readiness of the many to unite against the threats and crude tactics of the few. Majority rule, commonly relied upon in truly democratic societies, is more persistently sought. Now, they are speaking candidly, each knowing the mind and heart of his colleagues. The kind of tension which results from knowing the truth and not daring to express it has been broken here in Paris. We must never forget that the United Nations was born out of the unity of the many in defense against the aggression of the few. The Second World War might well have been prevented had the few aggressors been convinced of the eventual unity of the many defenders. Our high purpose is peace. Not one of us is willing, however, to purchase peace at the price of slavery. Through the United Nations, we are collectively making that plain to those who might otherwise misinterpret our desire for peace and thus risk war by a creeping form of aggression and domination. Whether or not one nation or several are presently prepared to accept the fact, we live in a world which is interdependent. No nation can long survive and progress which attempts to fly in the face of this fact and live in isolation. Such a nation must either ruin itself or find a way to cooperate for the general welfare. In this assembly, more than at any previous time, the interdependence of peoples is being frankly recognized. But tension arises from the question in the minds of many: will we be able to get the necessary measures into practical operation before a further test of arms? It is my conviction that given patience, determination, and unity among the majority, supported by the moral power of their peoples, we can block the road to war and induce all to travel the only safe road, that of peaceful cooperation.
Then you must feel that we are not misplacing our hopes in the United Nations by celebrating United Nations Week and Day. In your view, the United Nations is not as weak as some critics claim.
Its strength is the strength of those members who abide by and support its principles. No stronger. The United Nations is the many, standing together in collective strength, helping each other and serving notice on the few that the risk of aggression is foolhardy. John, I believe that the United Nations is getting stronger month by month for 2 reasons. First, the majority as such, or through regional arrangements, is proceeding by collective measures to strengthen each member nation. Second, the members of the overwhelming majority are speaking in the United Nations with increasing force and clarity. That in itself strengthens the collective defense front, because while warning the minority, it inspires confidence in each sector of that front.
All right, let's come down to cases, Ambassador Austin. What do you think the United Nations has to its credit up to now?
It has more to its credit than I could list in the time we have. In the past 3 years, it has put together the most comprehensive machinery for dealing with international interests the world has ever seen. You will recognize the importance of that if you feel as deeply as I do that the facts of the modern world require such machinery. As you recognize the vital necessity for it, you also want to move heaven and earth to make it work better. Naturally, it requires infinite patience and planning to achieve agreements among many differing peoples. To organize machinery to deal with economic and social issues, world health, food and agriculture, population problems, education, culture and scientific advancement, international trade, currency stabilization, investment in reconstruction and development, advancement of dependent areas, and Pacific settlements of disputes. But without such machinery to work with, we as civilized societies and in an interdependent world would be doomed. With it, the way to a peaceful future is charted. We need only the intelligence and unity to utilize it. So the very construction of the facilities of the United Nations is an important item on the credit side. Moreover, I think world opinion has forced nations to use these facilities of the United Nations both as a means of constructive collaboration and as a substitute for physical contact. We are moving toward multilateral trade and away from economic warfare by practical steps taken through the International Trade Organization and the Food and Agriculture Organization. We are at last talking about the kind of world that is possible and learning that it is attainable. The various agencies of the Economic and Social Council are guiding these efforts. Of course, we can't expect to move forward until we get agreement on the direction. Distance is not so urgent as is direction. In the field of security, we see evidence every week that nations are going to the United Nations rather than to the battlefield. Just remember the list of possible starting points of war. Iran, Greece, Indonesia, Palestine, India. These cases were put before the Security Council, and who can say which one might have otherwise ignited the fires of world conflict? In Paris, the three powers have taken the case of Berlin to the Security Council. Nobody predicts how the issue will be resolved. But in the choice of forums, the United Nations has our strong initiative and support.
Well, how do you feel, Ambassador, that the United Nations has a fair chance of arriving at some settlement of the major issues between the East and West?
Whether the chance is good, fair, or poor, it is the kind of chance which we chose to take. I don't see much to be gained from speculating on how good are our chances of getting peaceful settlement of this rift between the majority of the United Nations on the one side and the small minority led by the Soviet Union on the other side. If the peoples and governments of all the world, with the exception of some 300 million and less than a dozen states, can stand together on principles, the chances are good. Very good. If the great majority who want freedom and security in their rights haven't learned the lesson of World War II, I suppose the chances of peaceful settlement are poor. For my part, I believe that the real unity of the majority and the expression of it in the United Nations, where the minority can hear it, offers our best hope of eventually getting that settlement.
So you think the debating of these differences inside the United Nations rather than outside is a good thing?
Since the differences exist, the place to debate them is inside the United Nations. Again, I am convinced that World War II could have been prevented and the differences between the contending forces settled if the aggressors had known in the beginning how many did stand together in the end. That is a moral as well as a military equation. And that has to be discussed, for it is the righteous zeal of informed public opinion that must help us to our goal.
I gather then that you would consider that regional cooperation, such as the moves for Western Union, strengthen the United Nations. Is that correct?
To that I can make a short reply. Yes. We live in the kind of world in which nations are threatened by what they fail to do in cooperation with each other, as well as by military power from the outside.
One more point, Ambassador Austin. Do you see any hope of strengthening the United Nations with an international force?
Yes, I do, John. I think, however, that in a very practical sense, an international force exists now, which is a powerful deterrent to aggression and domination. That is the force of public opinion to which I have already referred. The moral judgment of the world community. The determination of the peace-loving and peace-demanding member nations to unite in support of the Charter. Of course, I want to see the members of the United Nations place contingents of their armed forces at the disposal of the Security Council, as envisaged by Article 43 of the Charter. I want to see the burden of armaments lifted from the shoulders of people struggling to reap peaceful rewards for their labor. I want to see atomic energy and armaments generally brought under international control with effective, enforceable safeguards against violation of agreements. While we go on working toward these objectives, we must keep strong at home, and we must confront our strength with our friends abroad. If we remain steadfast, we can be confident of the ultimate triumph of the United Nations.
Thank you, Ambassador Austin. This is John McVane of the United Nations in Paris.
The speaker was United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Warren Austin, interviewed by John McVane in Paris, preceded by Assistant Secretary of State George Allen and Mr. Clarence Francis. Tomorrow, the work of the United Nations will continue in the halls of the Palais de Chaillot and in 100 outposts across the globe. We are all of us involved, America. All of us. For we can affect the decisions that are made there. What the final decisions will be on the critical issues now before the United Nations, no man, as Ambassador Austin has just underlined for us, no man can say. But this, surely, we all must feel. That in the United Nations lies man's best hope on earth. Let us then back up our experts with the force of public opinion, with the force of studied opinion, and let's never forget the alternative. In the words of the slogan for United Nations Week, which we now celebrate, we can work it out together or fight it out alone.
Living 1948 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC public affairs staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Your narrator was Ben Grauer, and Milton Katims conducted the music. The program was directed by Jack Cuny. Next week, Living 1948 returns at the same time with a drama document entitled UN Balance Sheet, Assets. You're invited to NBC's Sunday night party, 2.5 hours of rollicking entertainment tonight. Begin with Ozzie and Harriet, then listen and laugh straight through with Jack Benny and his gang, The Adventures of Phil Harris and Alice Faye, followed by Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, and Fred Allen tops off the merriment with tonight's guest, Tallulah Bankhead. Remember, for the best time of your life, the best time is tonight on most of these NBC stations. This is Mel Brandt speaking, and this is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.